let there be peace between us would be a proper greeting. Here again we have references to early Ethiopian scriptures, where the priest rising says, "I speak with the voice of Amen." This is a Christian priest. For he speaks with the voice, so be it. Or the voice of let there be peace. In other words, invoking or stating the presence of a divine power. The claims of Amenhotep, then, represent the foundations of the peace from the word tet, or tet, which is added. The place or the abode of that which is, so be it. So mote it be. And about this, let there be peace. Also, we find in Arabic the continuation of this in connection with reference to the Prophet. For whenever a pious Muslim uses the name of the Prophet, he always adds his equivalent to this thought. For he says, "Muhammad, upon whose name be peace." Let it be so. It is. So be it. And this carries the entire concept, strangely enough, of Amenhotep, which means the peace of Ammon, or the place which Ammon has provided. The place, so be it. Now within this tremendous concept of another world or another life, we have many, many divisions. And because of the very same circumstances that affect our modern religious thinking, perhaps the Egyptian was more astute than we are, because instead of saying that heaven is a certain place and having another man disagree with you and saying it is another place, the Egyptian assumed that both men were right, because there was more than one place. You had the place you wanted, another man had the place he wanted. You could not say that heaven is like this or heaven is like that. Heaven is that which is, and so be it. For each man, so be it. It is strangely a world of deserts, of things expected, things presumed to be true. Whereas in the material world, the great hierarchy of the priests, who were referred to in ancient times as the voices of the Great One, instead of a world of priests ruling over this other world, Osiris was himself the great priest king, the psychopomp of souls, the pharaoh, the immortal mortal, the God King. This was his world, his land. And why was he there? Because he had been foully murdered. Because he himself had been cast into darkness. Because his heavenly kingdom had been taken from him. And because he felt the great pain of sorrow, he was Lord of the dead because he had known death. And because he had known death, he bestows life. And he bestows that which he knows. And he redeems because he has been redeemed and has risen triumphant over death, and is therefore king of death. We find exactly the same concept in the Maundy ceremonies and services preceding Easter. where death rules the world for 3 days and three nights, where the candles are extinguished upon the tripod altar, where the disciples depart from their Lord and leave him in the darkness of the great pain. And therefore, in the Osirian cycle, death destroys death, overcomes death, and Osiris sits throned as the guardian of souls through the mystery of death. He has walked before them. He has left his marks upon the earth. They follow in his feet or according to his steps. They return to him. They become him. And he carries them across the mystery of the other life. In the plains of Aru, or in the great house of Amenhotep, there is the judgment throne, the magnificent abode of this Lord who is beneath the earth. The Egyptians sometimes represented Osiris as a mummy lying upon a low couch, and from every part of his body is bursting growing grain, wheat, barley, all kinds of things are growing from him, because he is the life that is locked in the earth. He has descended into the earth, and from the earth he is forever escaping, and he escapes through the souls which turn to him and receive his way of life. Thus, in the underworld, there must be quite an empire envisioned. And on the threshold of this empire is the great experience of the transformation. Well, the Egyptians liked to think of death under the term transformation. They did not like the idea of mortality at all. Therefore, it was the great change from one thing to another, from one place to another. And to prepare and appropriately devise this occasion, the Egyptians had their magical mortuary rituals. With the Tibetans, these rituals were usually imparted before death. In Egypt, it was assumed that the soul, in the form of the ka, which locked within it the Binu, or rational part, that this being, seated like the bird upon the tomb, could read the inscriptions, listen to the sounds, accept the instruction, and be guided thereby. Because of the fact that the Egyptian was also a rather conventional man in many things, the religious ceremonies of death were very elaborate. But the Egyptian was not much of a mourner. He was not much given to sitting around and wailing, because he could not conceive that death was bad, or the good gods would not have permitted it. But he had to show certain sorrows, certain respectable grief, things of that nature. So he simply hired professional actors to do it for him. And when an important person died, a request was sent for a suitable cast. And a dozen, 20, 50 expert mourners were engaged. These had no idea who was dead, but they howled uproariously, beat their brows and tore their garments, which were replaced afterwards. This was ceremonial, but it is not at all certain from any of the experiences that the Egyptian grief was more than a private thing. Naturally, the Egyptian missed those whom he loved, but he did not grieve for them. He grieved for himself because they were gone. He was sorry to lose them. It never occurred to him that they were badly off, or had any particular need of him. As one of the Egyptians says of one of the dead, "Thou hast so little need of me and I so much of thee. And that was his attitude. If there was any real consoling to be done, it should be bestowed upon the living. They were the ones who might have to change their ways of life, might have to make adjustments, might have to bring up children fatherless or motherless. They were the ones who had the harder part. Because actually, those departing followed the way of all life. It was just as natural and normal as changing your clothes. And it was the larger sorrow for those who remained here. But the soul, passing on, had certain problems to confront. Because the Egyptian, as his religion tells us, was a serious man as far as his codes of principles were concerned. Like all ancient peoples, he regarded his future happiness as closely associated with his obedience to the laws of his faith. This did not necessarily mean in Egypt that he had to worship a particular god or at a particular shrine. There were no sermons, there were no sects and creeds as we know them. We are not even sure that the Egyptian had a religious textbook, because the only books we associate with him in religion are those associated with his dead. We do not know that he had anything that corresponds to a Bible. We do not know that he had any version available to him of words attributed to his God or anything of that nature. But he was permeated with a code that extended throughout his culture. And this code was a very simple one, essentially. It was a code to keep the law, both the law of God and the law of man, to live uprightly, to pay his debts, and to leave this world a better place than he found it, if such was possible to him. That he should not have inordinate attachments, unreasonable desires, or selfish ambitions. And the great negative confession of the dead, as found in the Book of Coming Forth by Day, tells us that if he in any way took seriously this tremendous credo, he must have been a reasonably honorable man. Because I doubt very much if anyone could say upon obligation and oath today that he was doing it well. Now the Egyptologist laughs it off, and we must give him his due, because you will hear from him again someday. He tells us that the Egyptian never attempted to live it. If he did not attempt to live it, then his entire religion was a travesty. And we are inclined to doubt that that is possible. Men do not build such tremendous things. They do not sacrifice for so many centuries, bestowing all that they have upon the glory of their gods, simply because they are not believers, or because it means nothing to them. In Egypt, as in modern Israel, men built first the temple, then the home. And that is the concept everywhere in that world. We cannot believe that it was totally insincere. More likely, more reasonably, the Egyptian realized, as we all realize, that he would fall short of perfection. But like us, he had a hope. In fact, he had several hopes, some of them rather concrete, at least to his thinking. One was that the world was ruled by a God who had suffered and died as he would suffer and die, betrayed by his own brother. Furthermore, that this God had given birth out of himself to an eternal Son, his own beloved and only embodiment, and that this Son was an intercessor for the souls of the dead, and that the Son, speaking to his Father, asked forgiveness for those who fell short. The Egyptian also believed that a degree of failure was not as catastrophic as it would be in a different type of religion. Because, remember, he believed that there was a gate of the west through which he would pass into darkness, but also another gate in the east from which he would be reborn. He therefore held the doctrine of rebirth, and this gave him a conviction that perhaps he was not intended to be perfect all at once, He was rather intended to do as well as he could and be able to honestly say that he tried and tried hard. And that seems to be the principal thing required of him. Beyond that, at the time of death, he was given a series of formulas, magical invocations, which he neither understood nor was able to generally apply. But each of these formulas would take him by one of the guardians of the darkness, and therefore would bring him safely into the judgment hall where his true nature could be properly and honorably assessed. For Osiris was also a god whose body was filled with eyes, as in the story of the Papyrus of Ani. And the eyes of the god Osiris saw in all things and in all directions and through everything, seeing the hearts in things and not deceived by the appearances or even by the minds of those things. Thus the Egyptian probably had a faith, a reasonable belief of a probable salvation. He also recognized, however, that in this world he got poor training for another world. Long before it had ever occurred to the majority of Western men, the Egyptian was beginning to estimate the problem of what he was going to do when he got into these wonderful houses of Amenhotep. He was not foolish enough to really think that he could plow the back 40 acres in the Elysian fields. He was not so completely lacking in imagination that he assumed that he could continue forever to have his slaves or to build monuments to his own memory, which may have been one of his principal avocations during life. Speaking of all this monument building, there is another interesting thought. Records have been found to indicate that all these great monuments were not necessarily testimonials to egoism, because the records tell us that there were great famines in the land, or that the Nile failed, and that the crops failed, and that there was no work for men. And one of the edicts says, and Pharaoh say, that no man can be honorable if he is merely supported by another. Said it is wiser to provide work out of the treasury so that all men will still be paid for what they do and idleness will not be rewarded. Now, we could bear that in mind on a number of occasions. Pharaoh apparently did have a god whispering in his ear at that moment. But in any event, the Egyptian, assuming that the soul had passed in its own way through the great trial, the psychostasia, which we have described to you on many occasions and which perhaps we can not go into detail in again. The psychostasia does not represent an arbitrary code. The psychostasia did not mean that all men must pass the same test, for there was not some blazing covenant upon the walls of heaven. Each man had to be weighed according to his heart and its relation to truth. Therefore, if his heart was simple and he kept the law, the balance was still maintained and he was permitted to pass on. Heaven was not for the scholar alone, for the wise man, or for the man who had cultivated virtues knowingly all his life. The great judgments all also found it good to weigh the heart of the simple man and reward him according to his simple works. No more was requested. He was not expected to know what truth was. He was only expected to keep the faith he had and live according to the good in his own life. So he passes on according to the Egyptian legends and fables, and in life he was a man of consequence, a very popular man in the community. He was the moneylender. Now, the moneylender in Egypt usually had his office on the steps of a prominent building. Here he set up his little scale and charged as usurious a rate of interest as the conditions would permit. But if he was a good moneylender at heart and believed in his gods, he gave honest weights and measures. He charged the rate that was the legal fee, proper and appointed. And perhaps occasionally, when some rather destitute person came along, he was a little larger hearted than the law demanded, took only 5% when he might have had 6. But anyway, we will assume in this case that he was a good moneylender. And there was such a man in one of the old papyruses, and we know about him. And we know that he balanced his scales at the portico of the Temple of Ra. And there, he advanced funds on this and foreclosed funds on that. And the time came and he passed on. And apparently, he got through the great examination with some credit. Evidently, he had not put his fist on one end of the scales when he weighed things. And because of that, he passed into one of the rooms of Amenhotep in the great hall of Aten. And so what did he do? What would you naturally think he would do? Found a good spot and set up business. Now we may wonder just what kind of a heaven it is if somebody else had to borrow money. It would make heaven almost too unheavenlike for most of us and too heavenly for the usurer. The books do not tell us who borrowed from him. Perhaps no one did. Perhaps in the afterworld no one needed to. Perhaps it was all that he required was to realize that he was doing business on the same old corner. No one liked it. But the Egyptian did not assume that death would separate or change these values. It might take the body away from the money changer, but it would not change him. So in the plains of Amenhotep, we have a situation set up that is very similar to the Hindu philosophy. Namely that in the afterlife, we live on in the consciousness that we have already developed, whatever it may be. The story of the moneylender is probably fabulous, but at the same time, it points the principle that heaven, for each man, must be the place of his own fulfillment. He must do the things he believes. He must find the rewards he expects. And a heaven suitable to Socrates would be very, very unsuitable to the moneylender, and vice versa. Those who have sought great and wonderful truths would not be satisfied with their little ethereal cottage on the ship by the side of the eternal sea. Each according to his inner life passes into another world. There goes on being himself, dreaming the dreams that have kept him and maintained him or directed him during his mortal existence. Now if this person did not pass the great judgment, he might go to places which were not so pleasant. But there was no concept of hell. What he really did was to go to the kind of a place that he had created upon the earth. If he had made a bedlam out of his home, he would find a magnificent domestic bedlam waiting for him. He would go right on, causing the troubles and experiencing. Because the Egyptian had already learned, as the Greeks learned from him, and they have told us, that the Egyptian concept of the afterlife was that each individual lived in the consequences of his own conduct. That the afterlife was the place where man lived with himself. That after the body was no longer there, and his faculties were no longer objectified and focused upon material things, this focus of power moved inward and settled within the magnetic field, so to say, of his own emotional mental life. Here the individual came face to face with himself. Here he had to get along with himself. And if the way we do it here is indicative, it would be well possible that over there he might have troubles at times. The individual who did not have a nice self to get along with was miserable. The individual who died in the excesses of dissipation, of selfishness, of greed, this individual had to face the sorrows which he had caused. Not because some deity did it, but because within himself was a tremendous complex of destructive forces from which he was not separated by death. This went on with him. This was the demon that tormented him. This is the power of Apep to beguile him. For he had fallen under the illusion, had failed to serve the gods, and had failed to seek the good. And for these failures, he must live in darkness. Now in the Egyptian mythological concept of the afterlife, the lowest, and the most negative of all these houses in Amenhotep, was the house of the great sleeping. If the individual had within himself no light, no greed, or if in the terms of the ancient times he died denying the gods and denying his own sharing in them and denying his own part in the afterlife, this had no essential effect upon his drifting into this world beyond. But it meant that he drifted there with a state of internal rejection. As the old texts tell us, this man, though still alive, refused to live. He said, "I am dead," and never questioned who was saying it, or how the dead could know that they are dead. He had preconceived his own destruction, his own annihilation, or through the evil of a conscience, had declared that he was not fit to live. And upon his departure, was utterly and completely ashamed of his conduct in life, and realized or believed that no good could come to him. Such as these, according to the Egyptians, were like those described in the visions of Aeneas, sleeping in the darkness. They were sleeping in strange, dark recesses. And when some came among them and shook them, they mumbled, "Disturb me not, for I am dead." And the Egyptian said that the only person who could say this was the person who believed in death. But death was a believing in death. And that there was no death but that believing. But having believed and being convinced of belief, man defends the belief with his own life. He cannot destroy himself. Therefore, he can only decline or reject the conscious existence of that which he is. So he sleeps. And if the present trend of materialism continues to flourish, areas in that particular region may become a bit congested. Because there are many who today claim, at least, to believe that there is no life after death. The Egyptian, however, held that this great sleep was not eternal, because a man can even be tired of being dead. He can even exhaust his own determination to prove that he is right. And because the maintenance of error requires continual vigilance, and he must carefully preserve his own darkness, he becomes weary, lets go, gives up. And like the man who has clung overlong to a piece of wreckage, decides that it is easier to be drowned. In this case, easier to believe than to deny. Easier to live than to die. Because according to the Egyptian, men have to cling to death. If they let go, they live. Now, if the soul finally lets go, and it will sometime, because eternity can outlast the stubbornness of the most adamant creature. So eternity is patient, and it always wins. So when men let go of this unbelieving, we are reminded of the vision that is recorded in one of the rituals of the Eleusinian, where the candid state sees the great waves of sleeping souls flowing by him in the river of life. And the souls that have finally let go of the fixation of death find that they are floating, asleep perhaps, partly awake, but floating on and on, joining together like streams with all those souls flowing from the other gates, until all the gates merge and mingle, and the great stream pours back into life through the great doorway of the East. And in flowing back into life, they behold, as they approach, Anubis standing again upon the horizon, this time the horizon of the East. And we are remembered of a certain symbol of two St. Johns standing at the equinoctial and solstice points of a sphere. We are reminded of the gates of the East and West. And here Anubis stands ready as a bandmaster or the leader of a parade to act as the cyclopompus or the herder of the secret and sleeping souls. And as they gather at the gate, dawn comes, and out of the great stream flows the wonderful ship of Osiris. The luminous bark of the dawn, and in it is the god surrounded by light. And upon the ship are the souls of the redeemed. They flow with him into the great mystery of the day. Therefore, life, birth, is a coming forth by day. Death is a going forth by night. And there are two nights and there are two days. And both kinds are parts of day because they belong to the mystery of the sky and the air, are in the keeping of Isis, mother of mysteries, who must give birth to the man-child for the salvation of the world. And those who come forth by day come forth under the patronage of the mother, and they are born. And those who go forth into darkness by night and death meet there the dark virgin Nephthys, who gives them birth into the underworld. Now there is a second coming forth by day, for unless a man be born again, he shall not know the kingdom of God. And that which is called the second birth is the house of the great mystery. the great house of the Lord of Amenhotep, the great white house of Memphis. For this is the house of initiation into the great rituals, the house of the second birth. And over this presides again Isis, for Isis is the mystery temple, the mother of the sons, the mother, the widow, whose son shall inherit the earth. So all those who come forth by day are, as Kipling says in his poem, we are the sons of the widow. And because Victoria thought he meant her, she refused him knighthood for a number of years. That egocentric old lady didn't realize that there was anything in widowhood beyond the weeds of Windsor. But the widow is Isis seeking for her lord. It is nature seeking for the hero, for the great power that is to redeem it, and which is fashioned in the image of the Hierophant, or the Lord of the Mysteries. So souls coming into birth or rebirth materially, following the great way, a path of light, the rippling left behind by the ship of Osiris as it cuts through the deep sea of the sky. But Osiris also rules in that other ship, the house of the mysteries, the ship of the darkness. And those who come forth in this house, into the house of truth, shall never again know night. For in the land of the redeemed there shall be no darkness. And in this concept, Osiris then becomes the Lord of the coming forth by day, the Lord of man's conscious decision to dedicate himself to truth, and to leave the shadows of birth and death as they burden the average man, to step into the immortal light of ever-consciousness. And those who achieve this immortal light are the Hasheshti, the radiant hawk-headed ones, for the hawk is the Egyptian phoenix, the symbol of the reborn, that which has risen triumphantly from its own dead, for the phoenix is born from its own body. And these, the Hasheshti, become the luminous ones who ride with Osiris in the ship of the sky. And they are the ones to whom he gives dominion over the air and the earth and over the powers of the sun. And they are the ones who in the last great war shall form the army of the enlightened and shall end forever the power of Apep, the serpent of darkness, the symbol of illusion. For light alone, the light of the soul, rescues man from illusion. So the Egyptian believe there is an overworld of truth in which the sun, as light and truth, rides supreme. There is an underworld of darkness, which is only illusion. And as Akhenaten himself said, actually, death is only a dreaming from which men waken into the love of God. So we cannot say the Egyptian was not a pious man, or that he did not have a wonderful and beautiful philosophy if we wish to look for it. Everything depends upon the way we approach it. 600 years before the beginning of the Christian era, Thales of Miletus was raised to great honor, and naturally, desiring to be a good citizen of Greece, he went to study in Egypt. Another great Greek, Solon, appointed Archon of Athens, and confronted with the problem of the mortgage stones, which had wrecked the economy of Greece, went to Egypt in search of wisdom. Pythagoras beat his body against the temple of Thebes for years, begging admission. The ancient world of the Mediterranean made its long and constant pilgrimage to the temples of Egypt, because men realized that there was a strange knowledge about the reality of things. And they knew that the Egyptians, under geometrical forms and solids, made likenesses of all their gods. And that they, and they mostly, were wise in the mystery of the soul, the journey of the soul through life and death, through darkness, the underworld, and out again into the great light of day, through the blazing gateway of the east. So the ancient Egyptians recognized three conditions. They hailed Osiris at his rising, saying, "Behold, he is the dawn." They venerated him at the meridian, saying, "Behold, this is the light that casts no shadow, for at noon there is no shadow." And they hailed him the third time, "Great Osiris of the sun in its setting, we venerate you, we adore you. For you are in your dawning the creator of all things, and in your meridian the preserver of all things, and in your setting the transformer of all things from one life to another." And the Egyptian also declared that there are three stations of the underworld: the gate of the west, which is the beginning of darkness, and is at the horizon of the double truths. Then there is the nadir, midnight, darkness, the lowest and deepest point of obscuration, where only the lunar Osiris floats in his little ship of the crescent orb. Then there is the third gate of the underworld, or the third station, which is the east, where the soul comes forth, perfected into light. Therefore, these three steps represent the three degrees of the mysteries by which men are regenerated, and the three degrees of life. For man must overcome not only the body, which is the west, but his desires, which are the south, and also his thoughts, which are the east. He must master them all and conquer them and pass through them into life. Now, if the Egyptian had this type of belief, I think we can appreciate how it profoundly influenced the rise of many other systems, including many phases of Jewish philosophy. In a very ancient description to Osiris, found in Egypt at a long and remote time, long before the captivity of the Jews, there is an inscription which says, "Hail Osiris Eloha." Now, that is a peculiar thing to find in Egypt, because Eloha is, of course, the root and source of the term Elohim, or the name bestowed by the ancient Jewish people upon the creating power. The great E division of Judaistic religious philosophy is based upon the Elohistic concept, as opposed to the later Jehovistic. So that Osiris Eloah, or Osiris Lord, indicates perhaps that from the temples of the Egyptians, it may well be true, according even to the biblical story, that Moses learned a great deal, for it is said of him that he was learned in the wisdom of Egypt. We know that the tabernacle of the Jews was patterned upon the Egyptian temples, and that the Ark of the Covenant is magnificently traced in stone upon the walls of the Temple of Bailey. These parallels may cause us to assume that out of the mysteries of Egyptian religion came many things. In ancient Syrian and Assyrian culture, and perhaps as late as the apocalyptic writings of St. John. For the judgment in St. John is certainly the psychostasia of the Book of the Dead. The judgment, the division, the restoration, the spiritual life of man over the darkness of the grave. We have comparatively few legends about these things. We know that in the psychostasia, at one period, it was believed that those who failed were devoured by Titan, who was present at the great testing, and who swallowed up the soul of the imperfect dead and voided it through his body. Of Typhon is the hippocampus, the creature of the Nile, the symbol of matter. Then that matter should swallow up the imperfect dead is almost a complete statement of rebirth, because Typhon was the lord of the objective material world, and he reclaimed those who failed in the test. Here we are again reminded of an interesting line in the Apocalypse, about which there has been much controversy, but it is perfectly good Egyptian philosophy. Whoso overcometh, him will I make a pillar in the house of my God, and he shall go no more out. This is a peculiar statement, but it parallels identically the concept of Titan. In other words, those who do not overcome must go out again. And through Typhon, they are reborn into a world of limitation and restriction. Like the Greek, the Egyptian did not resent rebirth. He did not even question it. He did not consider it a punishment for anything. Like the life itself, it was an opportunity. Mistakes would arise, tragedy would come, but life was good. And because it was good, it was worth living. And because it was worth living, man was forever grateful for it. And he was forever grateful for the conviction in himself that because of the infinite love and wisdom of his deities, his own life was eternal. He also believed that sometime, somewhere, some way, this great journey of birth and rebirth would end. He believed that sometime he would no longer be imperfect, and it would not be necessary for him to go out. And that when he had achieved to this end, he would have a place in everlastingness and be forever with his God. But again, because of the very concept that he had of God, based upon the same numerical speculations which later inspired Pythagoras to develop the monad theory, for the Egyptians were the source of his information, as he himself admitted. If the Egyptian could not conceive of ultimate existence apart from his God, even in the psychostasia, the deceased person is no longer himself. He is Osiris. When the priest Ani enters the underworld and the great papyrus named after him, he is referred to thereafter as Osiris, who was Ani. He has ceased to have an existence apart from his God. He has returned into a nature in which there is no essential division between himself and the divine. This is apparently an implication of a superphysical state. He stands forming the aspect of the Ka, which is a symbol that he is a soul, a being out of body. But he also held that at the end of things, he would not be a god. He knew, some way, mysteriously, that there was but one supreme power. In spite of the fact that the Egyptologists deny this, the entire structure of Egyptian theology requires it. And therefore, he must end by identification. Even in death, he becomes Osiris. In the last great enlightenment, which is the final unification of himself and eternity, he is truly Osiris. He is one with God in glory and in splendor. One eternal. He is not a God. He does not live in a paradise with God. For these houses of Amenta pass away. They are only part of worldliness, part of an illusion. Half of this illusion objective, half of it subjective. Death and the afterlife are dreams, just as living, physical living, is a dream to the Egyptian. There is only one final waking, and that is through the second birth, the mystery of truth, the internal enlightenment. When this comes, when the second birth comes, the soul is perfectly and completely osirified. That is, it becomes the God. It becomes not a God or one of the gods, but the very being itself. For there can be but one being, and all else is unreal, because God and God alone is real. Realizing this, we have a very high concept of the abstract end of this path of growth. Perhaps this concept was taken partly from Asia, where it was long taught as part of the secret mysteries of India. For we know that the Osiris cult is said to have been driven from India to Egypt in the form of a bull, or under the symbol of Apis. And Apis, of course, is the son of the equinox, or the symbol of the breaking of the egg of the year, or the horns of the celestial bull, which plows the furrows of stars and releases the spirits of the seeds from the sky. These things give us, perhaps, a little concept. And let us think about it. Is it so very much less realistic than our own? Is it essentially any different? Have we any better answer? Do we have any nobler concept than that we shall pass into a compensation or a condition suitable to ourselves, and that we shall live to grow and to learn until finally we merit enlightenment, and that through this enlightenment we become one with God? It seems to me that it would be hard to fail to see the essential sublimity of this concept, and perhaps even to admire the tremendously adroit use of symbols, so that profane centuries could never solve the mystery. And like the secrets of the glyphs themselves, the sacerdotal secrets are locked in shadows, in statues, in carvings, and in fragments of ancient papyrus. Yet if we are inclined to assume that they knew little and we know much, perhaps this is only what Hermes predicted over 2,000 years ago when, gazing upon the ruins of Egypt, he declares that the time would come when races and nations would rise and would really and honestly believe that the Egyptian had no ideals and no dreams, that he did not understand, that he worshipped beasts and birds. But Hermes pointed out that those very ones who accused him would also be worshipping beasts and birds of some kind. That those who did not believe he knew would themselves be bowing down to false gods. So perhaps Hermes was not so far from it. But anyway, this gives us perhaps a little panorama of the Egyptian life way as it relates particularly to life after death.